So what we'll try to do is, over the next 40, 45 minutes, is to give us the opportunity to hear Archbishop Rowan reflect upon these the dialogue and its consequences. So if I may begin, I think we'd like to hear something about the theological dimensions of the dialogue and how you think that the theoretical aspects of that engagement have a contemporary relevance.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for your introduction. I was very deeply moved by having the opportunity of this engagement in Bangalore and came away feeling deeply enriched by it. I think that I know I've been aware before that Hindu philosophies and spiritualities were not monochrome. I don't think I had quite such a vivid sense before of how lively the conversation was and how very, very sophisticatedly the differences are often expressed. And to be in the presence of representatives of such very distinguished lineages in the spiritual tradition of India was in itself a huge privilege. A couple of things struck me very much at the very theoretical level, and please bear with me if I begin with the very theoretical, I'll try to be a little more practical later on. These things struck me partly because of the echoes they evoked within Christian discourse. To take just one example, the question much discussed in some of the schools of the relationship between choice or liberty and the act of the divine or the transcendent, where I found distant echoes of many familiar controversies about grace and nature and grace and free will, the different analogies favored by different schools about the relation between transcendent and human action, the cat with the kitten or the monkey with its child, that kind of contrast. The little monkey clings on, the kitten is held. So that certainly sounded familiar, and it was intriguing to follow through how that kind of debate had affected the histories that we were reflecting on. A second area which struck me very much was quite familiar question of what do we actually mean by God's transcendence? Do we mean an absolute difference in the sense that what is contingent and immediate is substantially other than God, with the risk there of making God another object alongside the objects we're familiar with? Or do we mean that God's transcendence is the inexhaustibility of God's action in and through all that we encounter? Again, an issue debated among some of our interlocutors on that occasion, and something which, for me, brought up recollections of the debates in the Middle Ages, especially Eastern Europe, about the distinction that has to be drawn between the essence of God and the operations or energy or action of God, and how, while you may say quite a lot of things about the one and about the latter, there is absolutely nothing you can say about the former because it is never there in front of you as an object. The whole issue of the otherness of God. Again, in the Western Middle Ages this time, the phrase comes up of referring to the transcendent as non-aliate, not other. And that, from the heart of the Catholic Christian tradition, is, I think, a phrase that echoes significantly and interestingly in the debates that we were sharing in Bangalore. So I mention those things simply to give some sense of how I felt I'd been drawn into the most complex and sophisticated debates within another tradition, and found there echoes and reflections of some of the things that are at the heart of my own. And for me, an encounter like this always sends me back to my own tradition to ask, how far is my tradition hemmed in or limited by easy or crude versions of what I believe, so that very simplistic ideas about transcendence and freedom are all too readily accepted within the Christian world? How do I take on board the implicit critical questioning from another tradition? And how do I also reflect that critical questioning in return? Now, all those are, it seems, very abstract issues, and I'm not suggesting that we spend the rest of the morning discussing the parallels between Shankara and Meister Eckhart or Nicholas of Cusa, as better lines than mine have done in the past. I suspect that would send a lot of people to sleep rather quickly. But behind it all, within it all, there lie some intriguing questions about the nature of human action, human liberty, human responsibility. Some intriguing questions about the level or degree of dependence upon God that a mature human being may have. The role of what I'd call self-criticism and self-questioning in religious practice, and the stripping away of illusions and myths of how God is and how we are. And ultimately, of course, that question on all people of faith these days more than ever have to focus, which is how do we, in a world that systematically trivializes what human beings are capable of, how do we together propose to the world about a different model of humanity, a model that does justice to the depths of what it is to be human. So those are just a few initial rather rambling reflections on a debate which I found very stretching and very enriching.
Thank you. I think, if you don't mind, before we go on to some of the other practical issues, if I could ask, just still staying at the partly theoretical level, what were your feelings about the connection between these theological or rather theoretical questions on the one hand and the lived life of these traditions on the other, that in terms of worship and practice, clearly they're concrete manifestations are in their ritual detail and in their visual appearance completely different. And yet, perhaps, the structures of how people worship and meditate is intimately tied in the same way. How did you think that, on the one hand, the relatively easier comparability between these theoretical ideas mapped onto these practices?
It seems to me that the heart of so many of the practices represented is indeed something to do with challenging what you think you know about yourself. And ritual, practice, tradition, and language become part of that questioning of an unawakened or buried or silenced self. And I suppose, to me, in the dialogue with more than one of the Oriental traditions, what emerges again and again as the tough and demanding theme is this question about being awakened, enlightened, if you like, in one set of idioms, but awakened. We are habituated to falsehood about ourselves and the world. We must habituate ourselves to truth.
As you'll recall, we had this very interesting initial exploration where each of you said something about the core beliefs you had and the theological structures within which you lived. We then went on to talk a little bit more about the social dimensions. And I think in particular, we were looking at how the differences in traditions now in India, not just within the Hindu traditions, but between other traditions, also brought up certain social challenges. What did you make of that?
Well, one of the things which I was interested to try and explore in the conversation was what model of human dignity people were working with. And I was interested by the consistency of the responses we had to that, the sense of something inexhaustible in the truthful identity of the human being, and that being a foundation for a politics of profound respect at the end of the day. Now, we admitted, both the Hindus and the Christians present, we admitted that our histories had not been straightforward in this respect, that our traditions had, in all kinds of ways, been part of, been collusive with different sorts of oppression, different sorts of injustice, and that this was particularly notable when political power was allied with religious rhetoric. That, to me, was one of the strongest themes coming through our private conversation. The risks of allying religious language with political power, not mixing religion and politics, but reinforcing religious conviction with political power, using political power, conceiving its goals under religious dress, and therefore, unexpectedly in a way, I think we all understood the importance of a certain kind of secularity in politics, very much an Indian theme, of course, as we found out in many other contexts. Secularity not meaning an anti-religious climate, but one in which religion does not use political power for its ends, politics does not use religion for its ends, but the sense of what's due to human beings pervading and mingling and humanizing both worlds.
You said earlier that you distinguish that from the mixing of religion and politics. So presumably all of you do think that as public figures, there is indeed a way in which religion can, it need not just remain a private sphere
indeed.
In political life. How would you draw that contrast, and what would be the kind of manifestations you would think are acceptable or in fact required? Mm-hmm.
To use a phrase I've sometimes used in another context, I think there's a very crucial difference between religion being visible in society and religion being dominant in society. The visibility of religion is, ideally, the unself-conscious way in which the vision of humanity under God permeates the policies and politics we're engaged in and shapes the goals that we seek. As citizens, the visibility of religion means people have no qualms about saying where their convictions come from. I want this for human beings because of what I believe about human beings in the presence of God. That seems to me a robust and defensible and proper approach. To go on from there and say, and because my views are shaped by the vision of God and nothing less, it is my views that are going to prevail, never mind anybody else's. So there's an important transitional point there between visibility and dominance. The dominance of religion in politics is shown, I think, where actual freedom of conscience is repressed, where minorities are treated unjustly, where certain voices become absolutely invisible or inaudible in society. Because the visibility of religion means a willingness for all faiths to be visible in some way.
And what, presumably, if you compare the constitutional provisions in India and Britain, there are different ways in which this can be secured.
There are many different ways, yes.
But are there some fundamental requirements?
On the differences between India and the UK, it would be very interesting to hear people talk about this later on. India's secularism, public secularism, is very much based on the idea that the state creates an open space into which religious people may come, argue, engage with each other, be visible, but in which no one voice is allowed to drown out the others. That's, as I understand it, the tradition of Indian secularism, governmental secularism, and for what it's worth, I think it's a very healthy one. This country is of course, very strange. We do have an established church, and we have a history of being a confessional state. There was a time when, if you didn't belong to my church, you couldn't have certain kinds of jobs or go to certain universities. Well, that's all changed. And we now have a rather odd situation where the church is still recognized by law. And yet, in some way, the recognition of the church by the law of the land and the interweaving of some aspects of our church's life with politics has become a way of the state saying, we will take faith seriously. So people sometimes talk about the umbrella of the established church, but we are able to open the door and keep it open for other religious voices. So very different starting points, not completely dissimilar in practice, I think.
Referring back to your Chinning lecture, you mentioned in Delhi, you traced an intellectual connection between this requirement of a common space in which religions can coexist and the need for some kind of comparative theology. What do you mean by that, and could you say how that might play a role?
Yes, the term comparative theology is one that has been promoted by a couple of Christian writers recently, notably some Jesuit theologians, and I found that it was a helpful way of getting beyond some of the rather sterile patterns many of us have inherited. Comparative religion in the old style, the sort of thing I remember when I was a student, meant looking at all the odd things different religious people did and putting them side by side on tables and saying, well, there. I think comparative theology is trying to say what are the questions that different religious and spiritual systems are trying to answer? Are they the same questions across different communities? If not, why does that question matter there? Why does this question matter here? In a world where we can't avoid each other's company, is there a way of working in those questions together? Even asking, well, which is the more comprehensive, which is the more robust answer? And of course, there might be universal agreement about that. But I think it's an attempt to go beyond just comparativism or relativism, and say, we have got to find ways of really engaging on what we mean by freedom, what we mean by God, what we mean by grace, and so forth, and not assume from the beginning we know what the other party means. We know that they're asking the same questions, because they're not necessarily. And I think that careful work at why it is that the questions seem different, where the questions intersect and overlap, how we might find some language in common. I think that's part of what I'd understand as an aspect of what I've often called interactive pluralism in society. We can take pluralism in a society to mean simply that there are lots of communities with lots of different convictions, lots of different practices, and that's fine. But it seems to me that is actually rather dead if there is not respectful, lively engagement between those convictions and those schemes. Interactive pluralism.
And I can understand the undertaking of comparative theology as an academic exercise. How do you think that actually is played out in the development and sustenance of this kind of interactively pluralist society?
I think this is where we get down to grassroots and brass tacks, isn't it? It's what happens between individuals and communities in localities. Let me take a couple of obvious examples. People who share civic life in a certain environment may be faced with a question about something very basic, like speed bumps in the road. Now, this is a very long way from Shankara and Kusa. Yet the way in which you faith might address that. It's a context in which they will be bound at some point to draw out their sense of priorities. What is it that matters about the community we share in this area? What are the, I hate the word values in the room, but let's use it for once. What are the values we have that shape our choices? In spelling that out, people will, I think, be drawn to say, well, at the end of the day, I believe that because, and fill in that because I have a certain set of attitudes to the environment overall. I don't believe that speed of travel in automatic vehicles is the be-all and end-all of the human good. I believe that the damage that may be done environmentally is very serious, and I believe that the safety of human beings, both locally and on the global scale, matters because of what human beings are, because of that depth to them which is honoured by God in God's relation with what's made. The Christian will come at that in one way, the Hindu, the Muslim, the Jew in another. But the mutual learning that goes on there, the shaping of priorities, I think that's where it comes alive. And it comes alive sometimes in very complicated or even conflicted ways on other occasions. Let me take, and I'm going to go for a very controversial area here for a moment. Let's take the debates that have been around in this country and other parts of the Western world about the status of women and the way in which the status of women is actually expressed in the practices or the dress of religious people. The cliche is traditional religions, and of course Islam has a particularly bad name here in the eyes of some, but traditional religions repress women by the way in which they instruct or encourage women to dress. The message they give is that women are to be invisible. And that is very offensive to the enlightened Western mindset. And whether that's about the particularities and varieties of the Muslim custom of veiling, or indeed whether it's about other kinds of traditional dress that Hindu communities and Sikh communities know about too, some of these are the same. That's a point where I think, as a Christian and a Western Christian, we have to put the brakes on a simplistic version of the argument and say it's not about enlightenment versus barbarism. It's about some very complex ideas of what is due, again, to human dignity, understood in a certain way. And it's important that we quarry how far certain kinds of cultural habits are consistent with what's actually being said about human dignity. How far genuinely religiously anchored practices have got tied up with purely cultural and sometimes very repressive and even violent habits. A lot of disentangling, you know. I think that's comparative theology on the ground sometimes. But the willingness of a Western religious person to help to broker a discussion between the person from outside British, historical British culture, and the secularist, and say, hang on, listen to what's actually being said, is in itself a theological moment, I would say.
It seems that there's quite a high requirement of educational practices in doing this sort of comparative theology in practice, in action. Where would that come from? Do we need a reconfiguring of society's priorities in the first place, in which case, which comes first?
We certainly need higher levels of religious literacy in society. I don't think anybody in this room would be likely to disagree with that. We're up against a very ignorant administrative culture, very often. We need, I think, a practice of religious studies in our schools that is a bit more adventurous and a bit more questioning. than we often have. I've often spoken about my deep dismay years ago at seeing a very popular religious studies school textbook from a very reputable publisher, which was entirely about the externals. It was all about the odd things that different people do. And my shorthand for that is, this is religious studies as the study of eccentric foreigners. And very, very, very British approach in some ways, as we all know foreigners are peculiar. Now, that doesn't really get us anywhere, and I'm much more encouraged by the kind of thing that does appear in more reasonable recent syllabuses, which looks carefully, systematically at the ethical approaches of different faith traditions. And I want to push that back a little bit further, a little bit earlier, into the curriculum and draw it out a little. I don't think it's rocket science. I don't think it's all about people acquiring premature doctoral degrees in philosophy. I think it's simply about making the connections with these immediate daily challenges, the depth of an inherited tradition, and to see how it works in the lives of others. And sometimes that begins just by seeing how people's devotion works, by which I don't mean customs and festivals, I mean looking rather carefully at what people are saying and doing as part of their whole orientation of themselves in devotion.
So somewhat more explicitly then, drawing the connections between your experiences in India and the kind of issues that people gathered here today might want us to think about a little bit more. You were talking about the particular historical development of the established church in England, and of course we know about the changes brought about in the last 40 years through immigration and so forth. It's completely changed the society so that we can talk about speed bumps and clothes in a way that cuts across traditions. But the reality is that primarily because of a secular world in the Western sense of the term, of a world much more enthralled to consumerism and global capitalism, the impression is created that there's a very big ask on the part of people coming out of these traditions. And in fact, of course, amongst Christians themselves, there is a sense that the fullness of their lives are simply not recognized in the media, in public discourse. So simultaneously, I think on both sides, there is a sense that there's a lot more that needs to be done. How could we go about doing that?
Well, it's something on which I'd be very grateful to hear wider discussion. But I think all the efforts that we've made to increase the possibilities of the Hindu-Christian Forum, the work that's already being done in the Muslim-Christian Forum and the Council of Christians and Jews, many things like that, are simply ways of advancing and improving that grassroots exchange, which is not just taking up arms together against secularism, which would be a great mistake, but making sure that when we speak about faith in the public sphere, we speak not just in defense of one particular tribal group identity, but in defense of the liberties of a range of people, that we speak with understanding about one another in the public sphere, and that we seek to carry the discussion into the territory of secularism, gently, persistently, with a proper air of respect for the secularist as well.
We'll then move on to having the three speakers and then perhaps come back for after they've spoken to let the audience ask you questions. Is there anything else you want to say to sum up? Or should we?
I think the last thing I want to say is a very general principle which our dialogue in Bangalore reinforced for me, which I hope any further discussion and development of forums in this country will hold to, and that is the absolute obligation on all of us to be truthful about the other. That is, to give an account of the neighbour's convictions that they would recognise. We have all of us suffered from caricatures flung around one way or another. And when I read what some Europeans wrote about Hindus in the 17th and 18th centuries, my eyebrows rise considerably, because it's perfectly clear that no one has thought what would be a description recognisable to those who actually practice. I have to say that some of what Hindus and Buddhists have said about Christianity strikes me much the same way. I can't recognise what's being said. When you look at what was written by Christians about Muslims and Muslims about Christians in the Middle Ages, you think...
Or perhaps even today.
Well, I wouldn't like to answer, but, you know, the basic principle, what I say should at least be recognisable to the other person, even if they don't agree. That's something we all hold ourselves accountable to.
Thank you very much. So,